losers. So instead, I'll repeat the thank yous, the kudos to Remus and Joaquin for doing all of the significant work involved here. And also, I'd like to thank the speakers for giving a large number of very good talks. This talk is about something that's been close to my heart for many, many years, non-commutative Schottky boundary. And probably the place to start is by reviewing the commutative Schottky boundary. Now, I belong to the set of people who object to partial coverings of slides. But nevertheless, I'm going to partially cover that slide because the slide is too busy, you see? So I'm not going to allow you to be distracted by what's on the bottom. What is the commutative Schottky boundary? Well, you have a function system. In other words, just a self-adjoint linear subspace of commutative C star algebra, C of X, that separates points. And a point of X is said to belong to the Schottky boundary relative to S if it has a unique representing measure. Or equivalently, if evaluation at P, considered as a linear functional on S, if that extends to uniquely to a state of C of X, okay, unique state extension. So that's the point in the Schottky boundary. And for our purposes, actually Schottky proved several things that are important in this circle of ideas. But for our purposes, the important thing is that he showed that the closure of the Schottky boundary is not only non-empty, but it's the Schielhoff boundary. And the Schielhoff boundary, of course, is the smallest closed set K of X such that the restriction map of S into C of K is isometric. That's the Schielhoff boundary. And now, let me say something about the rather interesting, a little bit, about the rather interesting history of the Schielhoff boundary. Schielhoff, now I think I have this right. Maybe Dick or somebody can correct me if I'm wrong.
I didn't know you were going to do it, Bill, and I was going to make a comment afterward about it, but go ahead.
Okay. See, I knew you were going to do that, Dick. So I think this is correct. In the late 40s, Gelfand and Neimark published more or less an announcement in the Dokladis, I remember.
The early 40s.
Early 40s. 43. Aha, okay. And they announced the result that they attributed to Schielhoff that had been discovered by Schielhoff during the war years, which, if you're a Russian, started early, and had been unpublished. What they announced is that there's a minimal closed set K with the stated property, that the restriction map is isometric. And for that, they used the axiom of choice. And then they went on to assert that actually K is unique, and in fact, there's a smallest K. If you take any two minimal ones, they're the same. And the intersection of all the minimal ones is the same. So there's the smallest K. And so this result circulated in the West and created quite a stir, I understand. And there were several issues about it, not the least of which was that there wasn't a proof that had been published. But it didn't take long for people to find proofs, as I understand, to find a proof.
Not really?
Aha.
Showing that the self-adjoint elements had real spectrum.
Oh.
It was
okay.
Only after the war they sent the proof over.
Okay. Yeah, okay. That's interesting. I didn't know that, actually. Richard Arendt, bright fellow. Okay, so in any case, it created quite a stir. And one of the questions that that was kind of befuddling about it is, why in the world did they have to use the axiom of choice to prove that these minimals exist if there's a unique minimal? I mean, after all, if something's unique, you don't have to use the Hahn-Banach theorem or something to prove it. If there's a unique extension to a linear functional, you don't need the axiom of choice. But anyway, unfortunately, Choquet's result here also uses the axiom of choice, but in a different way. So anyway, I don't want to make a big thing out of the axiom of choice, except to create the to remind you that it created some a stir. So now we go non-commutative. Now I think I'll do it this way. What's the best way to do this? This is. That's a brighter. That's easier to read, isn't it? Compact perturbation. Okay. Some of this terminology will be completely familiar. Other parts of it maybe not quite so. An operator system, of course, I mean the usual thing, a self-adjoint linear subspace of a unital C-star algebra that contains the unit. And we can usually, if we want to, we can assume that this operator system generates the C-star algebra. That's, of course, the non-commutative counterpart of saying here that the space separates points. And by, I don't like abbreviations either, but of course I'm a hypocrite, and I'm going to use an abbreviation because it's convenient. UCP map, but it's sort of apparent what it means, a unital, unit-preserving, completely positive map. So, in fact, what we'll be looking at almost exclusively is UCP maps of a fixed operator system into B of H, so operator-valued maps. So what is a boundary representation? A boundary representation is an irreducible representation of the C-star algebra generated by S, okay, irreducible representation, with the property that if you restrict it to S, it has a unique, completely positive extension back up. Okay, so this is obviously a non-commutative counterpart of uniqueness of representing measure here. And let's let boundary sub S be the set of all such things. Really, it's a set of unitary equivalence classes of these boundary representations, but let's not be fussy. And so this is the non-commutative Choquet boundary, and nothing I've said should make you believe that it's not empty. Okay, there's an issue there, a significant one. So finally, the last bit of terminology is what I really want is not only for it to be non-empty, but I want there to be sufficiently many boundary representations. And by that, what I mean is if you take any operator in F and apply a boundary representation, pi, to it, and take the norm, and sup over pi, you get the norm of A. And similarly for n by n matrices, all the way up the matrix hierarchy. Okay. I feel like a Las Vegas dealer here. Okay, so why should one care about these things? I mean, you know, it's not just, there are more reasons than just simply generalizing something to the non-commutative realm here. In the first place, they have established importance in commutative analysis, many parts of commutative analysis, including, of course, potential theory and function theory. In fact, it arose in function theory. So what I want to point out here is there are new and rather different, very different, applications of these ideas in the non-commutative realm. So here's an example. It's an old example from 1972, actually, when I first did this work. But it's the following. choose your favorite irreducible compact operator, A. So, for example, you could be working in the Hilbert space L2 of the unit interval, and you could take A to be the Volterra operator. You know, A f of x is integral 0 to x, and f of t dt. Irreducible compact operator. And form the two-dimensional operator system consisting of A, spanned by A, and the identity. Oh, I'm sorry, I said operator system. That's not quite right. This is not self-adjoint. So this is not an operator system. It's an operator space with unit, a unital operator space. Well, it turns out that there's really no difference between unital operator spaces and operator systems. Okay, and sometimes it's easier to speak of unital in terms of unital operator spaces, or sometimes you want to, and other times operator systems. But everything I say here has an immediate counterpart in the operator space spanned by A star in the identity, and everything goes through in a straightforward way. I don't want to bother with that. Huh? Okay, now here's the point. And that is that if you take this operator system, then the identity representation, keep in mind this operator is irreducible, so the C star algebra generated by S is an irreducible C star algebra containing a unital, or containing a unit. And it contains all compacts. So the identity representation is an irreducible representation of that C star algebra, and you can ask, is it a boundary representation? And the answer is yes, it is. Okay, and that's the example, and as it's not very hard from this theorem to deduce the following corollary, which back in 1972 I was very surprised by and very delighted by. The corollary says, if you have two irreducible compact operators, okay, and if their corresponding two-dimensional operator spaces are isomorphic, in other words, this map, the lambda plus mu A goes to lambda plus mu B, if that map is completely isometric, then the operators are actually unitarily equivalent. They're the same, unitarily equivalent. Now, I was really excited about this result back there, and because it tells you that an irreducible compact operator is completely determined by a two-dimensional operator space. Okay, two-dimensional operator space. In fact, one of the dimensions is taken up by the identity, so it isn't, you know. I thought that was surprising. And, of course, all of us know, and I realized then, too, of course, that when you say completely isometric, that's saying more than just that this map is an isometry. Of course, it's saying something about the n-by-n matrices for every n. So there's more information in the hypothesis here than meets the eye. But nevertheless, it's a two-dimensional operator space. You don't need higher-order polynomials in A or higher-order matrix polynomials at higher levels. Linear polynomials are enough. Well, so I schlepped this paper off to the journal, and it was accepted, and I was very happy, and I sent out preprints and waited, as I was telling some friends the other night. So I sat back and waited for the postcards to come in. You know, in those days, people would send you postcards if they wanted a reprint. No postcards. Nothing happened. Very little. No, not nothing, but very little happened. I got a promotion. That's significant. Well, here's another reason to look for boundary representations, and that's something known nowadays as the Shiloff ideal. I introduced boundary representations in an earlier paper than this one, a couple years earlier. This was a SQL paper. And I had sort of a two-part program then. And the first part was to work out concrete examples like that one, you know, with applications to operator theory and so on. And the second part of my two-prong program was to use these boundary representations to show that there is a non-commutative Shiloff boundary in general. Okay. So the first part of the program was successful. And that was this theorem that said that, well, the first part of the program was successful. It was this paper got published. toward the second part of the program, I proved this theorem, that if there are sufficiently many boundary representations, not only do they exist, but there are sufficiently many of them, then the intersection of their kernels is the Shiloff ideal, is the largest ideal K with the property that the projection to C star of S mod K is completely isometric on S. So that's, I call that the Shiloff boundary ideal then, but now it's called the Shiloff ideal. And this embedding of the operator system into C star of S mod K is called the C star envelope of A, which is a nice term. Wish I'd thought of that one. So as I said, program B was not successful because I wasn't able to prove, in general, that there were sufficiently many boundary representations. Not only that, in general, I mean, you know, I had lots of examples, broad classes of examples, but not a general theorem. And in particular, I didn't know whether or not the boundary was not empty. The non-commutative Schottky boundary was not empty in general. So that's what this talk is about, that issue. Oops. This goes here. So let me give a couple of milestones along the way since those two papers I've already mentioned. In 1979, Masamichi Hamana established the existence of the non-commutative Shiloff boundary, okay, in general, for any operator system. And he did that by using his theory of injective envelopes, which turned out to be an important theory in its own right. But he was able to use that to establish the existence of, for our purposes, the existence of the non-commutative Shiloff boundary. And then years later, David Bletcher got interested in the non-commutative Shiloff boundary again and returned with some interesting work in that direction along about, well, the late 90s, 97 and 99. And around the same time, Paul Muley and Baruch did some work related to their work on C star Hilbert modules, Hilbert C star modules, whatever, in which they proved, and I don't think they stated it exactly this way, but they proved essentially that a UCP map of S into B of H has the unique extension property. What is that? I'll get back to it. If and only if it's maximal. What is that? I'll get back to that too. Okay, but they proved that these two properties are equivalent. And the proof is not difficult, okay? But it's a definite clarification of what's going on here. And then later, Mike Dritchell and Scott McCullough in 2000, well, the paper appeared in 2005, but it circulated before then, in a major step, showed that every UCP map of F into B of H can be dilated to a UCP map with the unique extension property. So now I'd like to explain about what those words are on the next slide, and I will. But the point I wanted to make at this moment is that, unfortunately, none of these results gives any information about the Schottky boundary, the non-commutative Schottky boundary, boundary representations. Okay. Okay, what about maximality and what's the unique extension property? Again, S is going to be fixed throughout the operator system inside C star of S. we have a UCP map phi of S. By dilation of that UCP map, I mean this, exactly this. Phi maps into B of H. A dilation of phi is a map psi that maps into B of K, where K is a superspace, contains H as a subspace, and where psi compresses to phi, in this sense. Now, it's more natural, if you think about Steinspring's theorem or something like that, it's more natural to think of a formula like this, that phi is equal to V star psi V, where V is an isometry, or equivalently, that phi is unitarily equivalent to something related like this. But it turns out this is a small but and delicate but important issue, that in order to get the proofs to flow properly, you need this definition of dilation, not this more sort of looser definition. So this is what I mean by a dilation. Actually, a compression from a map into a larger B of H. So what is maximality and the unique extension property? Well, if you have any UCP map phi, you can always get a dilation of it on a larger space by taking the direct sum of phi with some other map rho. Okay, that gives you a UCP map of S into a into B of K, where K is a direct sum of H with something. But that's obviously a trivial sort of dilation. Okay, so I'll say that phi is maximal if every dilation is trivial. It doesn't have any non-trivial dilations. So if you look at, you know, we've looked at lots of matrices of dilations in the past few days, and if you look at the corresponding matrix decomposition of psi, when psi is trivial, it's just a diagonal 2x2 block with zeros off the diagonal. Non-trivial dilations have entries in the upper right and lower left. So a maximal UCP map is one that has no non-trivial dilations. It's not clear that these things exist immediately, by the way, but nevertheless, that's the definition. And finally, what's the unique extension property for a UCP map? That's straightforward. It means pretty much literally what it says. It means that the map phi, of course, every completely positive map extends to a completely positive map of C star of S into B of H. But what I'm saying here is that there's only one extension, and not just that, but that the extension phi tilde is actually a representation, is multiplicative. So that's the unique extension property. It's saying that phi is the restriction of a star homomorphism, of a representation, and moreover, that phi has a unique extension, completely positive extension. Okay. I should point out, if you've read these papers, any of these papers I've referred to, that Dritzschel and McCullough use the term boundary representation for what I've called unique extension property, but obviously I can't do that because these things need not be irreducible. And when I use the term boundary representation, I mean an irreducible representation of C star of S that has the unique extension property. Okay, that's a boundary representation. And I've already pointed out that these two properties are equivalent. Maximality and the unique extension property are equivalent. It's not obvious from looking at the definition. It's not very hard to prove. A few lines in both directions. Three or four. Okay, so here's a new result. And this is going to appear in the journal AMS, probably not too long from now. It's already electronically posted at their website. So in some sense, it's already appeared. And of course, it's posted on the web, in the archive. So the main theorem is that every separable operator system has sufficiently many boundary representations. Okay. I'll come back to the issue of separability at the end of the talk. There's another formulation of this main theorem, as I called it, that seems to make a more concrete assertion, and that is this. If you have an operator system S, then it makes sense to speak of states. Positive linear functionals, I mean, operator systems have lots of positive operators in them because they have the identity and they're self-adjoint. They have lots of positive operators. So it makes sense to speak of states. And by a pure state, a pure state of an operator system is simply an extremal state, extreme point in the convex set of states. So here's another theorem which turns out to be equivalent to the main theorem. And the theorem says that every pure state, rho, of a separable operator system has a representation of this form. Rho of A is pi of A, xi dot xi, looks like the GNS representation, where pi is not only an irreducible representation of C star of S, but it's a boundary representation. Okay. Now, unlike, see, if we were dealing with states of C star algebras here, then this triple pair, pi, xi, as everyone knows, is unique up to natural notion of equivalence. Given the state, there's a unique up to natural equivalence GNS representation for it. These representations are far from unique. There may be inequivalent boundary representations that give you the same row, with appropriate vectors that give you the same row. So there's no uniqueness in this representation.
Bill, may I interrupt now? It's probably better at the end, but then we'll be away from that. Your operator system has a C star envelope, and you can extend the pure state to a pure state of every larger operator system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you can use GNS, so you can get this formulation, but the boundary is...
Exactly, yeah. That's right, exactly. What Dick points out is, in general, given any pure state of any operator system, separable or not, it can always be represented in this form where pi is an irreducible representation of the C-star algebra, just by going through this argument using GNS. On the extended pure state. The issue here is that this irreducible representation can be chosen, has the unique extension property. You can find one representation like this where pi has the unique extension property.
I'm just going to ask, there is a criterion for that uniqueness, a little odd, that's for later catalog.
We need to talk about that. Oh, yeah.
That's back to 1950.
Yeah, that works well in the context of function theory, by the way.
Sure.
Yeah, but problem with operators, I don't need to tell Dick Cadison this, problem with operators is the two self-adjoint operators don't necessarily have a least upper bound.
Right.
I love saying that to Dick Cadison. He taught me that. Yeah, so I wish there were a way to prove these results along those lines. I've tried. I can't do it. I can't prove it along those lines. As you'll see, my proof is different. And I suspect there may be a proof along those lines. But, in the future. Yeah. Okay. Okay, now let me say, just make a comment about the unique extension property for a UCP map. Okay, so we just have a UCP map and we're interested in the unique extension property. Now it's easy to see, if you have a UCP map with a unique extension property, and if somehow you can split that into a direct sum of two UCP maps. So find a projection that commutes with a range of phi, and use that projection to split up Hilbert space. You decompose phi into a direct sum of two UCP maps. Here's a little exercise that wouldn't take you more than a minute or two to do. I'm not going to give you the chance, though, because I'm going to keep talking. Little exercise is to prove that if phi has the unique extension property, then so do both sum ends. Okay. So it's hereditary in that sense. It's inherited by sort of submaps, where submap means this. So the key technical step in the proof of the main theorem is the following result, which I'll just state. I'll say something about the proof, but here's the technical fact, is that hereditary property actually goes over to continuous decompositions of phi into direct integrals in the following sense. Suppose we have a standard Borel probability space, x mu, and suppose that for each x, you have a UCP map of, for each x, you have a Hilbert space, H sub x, and you have a UCP map, phi x, onto that Hilbert space. And you want everything to be measurable, and it would take 15 minutes to say what that means, but everything is measurable. Let's not bother. Then you can form a direct integral of these phi x's. First you form the direct integral of Hilbert spaces, and then you can form the direct integral of these phi x's to get a UCP map acting on this Hilbert space. The theorem says if S is a separable operator system, and this integrated map, the direct integral map, has the unique extension property, then there's a Borel set of measure 0, n, such that on the complement, every phi x has the unique extension property. So that is some kind of continuous generalization of what I said in the first paragraph. So this is the key technical step. And let me say something about that. So uses something I like to call the dilation bundle, and that's this. Suppose we have the situation that we had in the theorem. In other words, a standard Borel probability space X mu, and a Borel measurable family of Hilbert spaces HX and maps phi X, UCP maps, S into B of HX. Then such a thing has a dilation bundle. And the dilation bundle is defined this way. For every x, you let script D sub x be the set of all UCP maps from HX from S into this particular larger Hilbert space, HX direct sum little L2. It's important, by the way, for technical reasons, that little L2 does not depend on X. So we take this larger Hilbert space, and D sub X is the set of all UCP maps into this space that compress to phi. So there's one of these sets, D sub X, for every X. So we assemble these into a total space, and we get some kind of bundle. Now, it's true, and again, I'm going to completely slough over this, but it's very important that this bundle has a standard Borel structure, a nice standard Borel structure. Okay, so here's the key step in the proof of the theorem. And that is, if phi x is not maximal for almost every x, in other words, if there does not exist a Borel set of measure 0, such that on the complement of that, phi x is maximum, then there's a Borel set of positive measure and a Borel section of the dilation bundle that is non-trivial all throughout this set of positive measure. Okay. Now, on the surface, this sounds almost like a tautology. Well, if it's not maximal almost everywhere, D 15 mu, then it must be not maximal on a set of positive measure, right? It's not a tautology. This requires proof. And actually, what one needs to do is sort of construct, in the sense of descriptive set theory, one needs to construct a Borel section. And at one one proves this by using the tools of standard Borel spaces, Polish, and the von Neumann-Mackey selection theorem. Okay, so that's the technical result. And let's assume we have it. So I'm just going to sketch how you assemble a proof of the main theorem, just the main, the key steps, the steps involved. Here's the way you prove the main theorem. Remember the main, what the main theorem says. Main theorem says there are sufficiently many boundary representations. And what does that mean? That means not only is the set of boundary representations not empty, but there are enough irreducibles in there to give you the norms throughout the matrix hierarchy. So that's what we have to prove. Okay, step one. Remember the result of Dritzschel-McCullough. Dritzschel-McCullough says that every UCP map could be dilated to a UCP map with a unique extension property. Okay, so we're going to one needs to modify that somewhat for separable operator systems, but anyway, it's not hard to do that. And you end up with the following. You can find, there exists, using Dritzschel-McCullough plus some standard manipulations, you can find, for a separable operator system, you can find a UCP map phi with two properties. A, it has the unique extension property, and B, it's completely isometric. So the image of S under phi of S, that operator system, concrete operator system, is isomorphic to S. So we can just confine attention to that concrete operator system. Okay, that's step one. Now step two, plug into open up Dixmier's book, the Old Testament, okay? A lot of that book is devoted to disintegration theory. And, read that book for a while. And after you get tired, put it down and come back the next day and read some more. And eventually, you come to an attitude where, oh, yeah, this is sort of standard. What you do now is you've got this UCP map phi. You can disintegrate that into a direct integral of irreducible UCP maps, phi sub x, over a standard Borel space, x mu. In other words, what I'm saying is there exists a standard Borel space, a standard Borel probability space, x mu, a standard bundle of Hilbert spaces, h sub x, and a Borel family of UCP maps, phi sub x, such that H decomposes into a direct integral, phi decomposes into a direct integral, and every one of these phi x maps has the property that phi x of S is an irreducible set of operators. Now, how do you do this? Again, this is sort of a standard device. Let's go back to von Neumann. You simply choose a maximal abelian self-adjoint von Neumann algebra in A, in the commutant of the self-adjoint set of operators you want to disintegrate, decompose. Choose a maximal abelian self-adjoint algebra in that von Neumann algebra. And then everything is separable, so we introduce coordinates for that massa, just like we teach students to do, and write that as being isomorphic to L infinity of X mu. Then, of course, this Hilbert space becomes a space of vector-valued functions over X. So we've sort of introduced coordinates here, coordinates with multiplicity. And then we decompose the von Neumann algebra, phi of S double prime, according to these coordinates with multiplicity. And you turn the crank, and out comes this. Now, it's important to keep in mind that there is no uniqueness here. And in fact, the lack of uniqueness of such decompositions has been a trap that has trapped several good mathematicians at one time or another, including Tomita. this is far from unique. Not only is there a lack of uniqueness in the way we chose a maximal abelian algebra, there are many ways to do that. It might have been a singular massa, a regular massa, there are many maximal abelian subalgebras of a factor even. Not only is there that lack of uniqueness, but there are other ways that lack of uniqueness can creep in here. So there's... Yeah, but even in type 1, there's the first... You can continuous masses, discrete masses, right. Yeah. Of course, it's the non-type 1 case that we need to deal with here. Okay. Now, we've got this disintegration of phi into irreducibles. So obviously, what I want to do, I want to show that each one of these is irreducible. Almost everyone is irreducible. Almost everyone is the boundary representation. But you see, we've got that technical theorem that tells us that. Technical theorem tells us that I sketched earlier, the one that involved the dilation bundle, the proof of which involved the dilation bundle. The technical theorem tells us that we can throw away a set of measure zero here. And after throwing that away, we can assert that every one of these phi x's has the unique extension property. So that means if we let's throw the bad set away. So that means that we can extend on the remaining x's, we can extend phi sub x to an irreducible representation pi x uniquely, and that pi x will be a boundary representation. Okay. So we have so what have we now accomplished? We now have phi written as a direct integral of boundary representations. Well, at this point, the game is over. The jig is up. Because you can just use this representation immediately to show that not only at level 1, but even for n by n matrices, that the norm of any n by n matrix of elements ai, j, and s is the essential soup norm, okay, of these operator matrices. Essential soup norm. That just comes from this direct integral decomposition. And then once you have this, I think you believe that this is, you can conclude that there are sufficiently many boundary representations. Okay, so that's sort of a sketch of the proof. I'd just like to make a couple more comments. First off, and last off too, can you drop the separability hypothesis? Can you drop the separability hypothesis? And, of course, the main theorem is equivalent to Theorem 2. So either way, if you could prove either of those two results, remember Theorem 2 was the one that said every pure state has a kind of a GNS-type representation where pi is a boundary representation. If you could prove that for inseparable operator systems, then you'd have the main theorem as well and vice versa. And so that's the question. Cautionary note. heroic attempts to remove separability hypothesis can lead into trouble. okay? Set theoretic truffle. And let me remind you of a recent result that makes that point very well. Chuck Ackerman and Nick Weaver, not long ago, a couple years ago, I guess, they constructed a counterexample to Neimark's conjecture. Remember Neimark's conjecture? If you have a C-star algebra, not necessarily separable, if you have a C-star algebra A with the property that any two irreducible representations are unitarily equivalent, then A is isomorphic to the compact operators on perhaps a big Hilbert space. And of course, that theorem is true for separable C-star algebras. It's a characterization of the compact operators. Separable C-star algebra with only one irreducible is the compacts on a separable Hilbert space. So Neimark conjectured that a similar theorem is true in general. Well, Ackerman and Weaver have constructed a counterexample to Neimark's conjecture by using a weird set theoretic principle that is not a part of ZFC, the usual axioms of set theory, but it's consistent with them. You can add this axiom in if you like, and there are models that satisfy all of those axioms. So they've shown that if you throw this weird thing in, then you can construct a counterexample. And they've also shown that the statement that there's a counterexample to Neimark's conjecture with Aleph 1 elements is undecidable within ZFC. Okay. Now, I don't know. At this point, I have to ask myself, you know, what am I doing here? Is this operator algebras or is this set theory? And it's both, of course. But anyway, a word to the wise. Hopefully, the main theorem is true without any of this shenanigans. Yeah, Zermelo-Frankel plus choice. That's the C. C is choice. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, then we can't. We're not doing, yeah. What we're doing is arithmetic. Yeah. Right. Okay. So, that's all I have to say. Thank you for listening.
Did you use the axiom of choice in your proof? Shame on you.
Actually, you usually don't have to use the axiom of choice in this descriptive set theory stuff. You know, you. But I don't know. I get confused any time I think about that stuff. So, what?
You're not using it, but it has been used with what you're using.
Yeah, that's what I'm
saying. Yeah, yeah.
Use Tychonoff's theorem.
Yeah. Oh, Tychonoff's theorem, definitely. That is the axiom of choice.
No, you may not have used it yourself.
Right.
But you, yeah,
right. In fact, I think somebody, Kelly or somebody, proved the Tychonoff theorem is equivalent to the axiom of choice. Yeah. I'm sorry? Oh, is that right? Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions?
Sure.
You referred back in your, I think it was your theorem 3,
the technical thing,
the
yeah.
The technical result, disintegration, and so on and so forth. You referred back to Mackey, Neumann. I'll say, first of all, that was a theorem that would have gladdened George Mackey's heart. It scares the hell out of me. Because errors are all over, subtle errors. And as you said, really, mathematicians,
You also did this decomposition relative to a massa in the commutron. That is 1949. That goes to Fritz Mountain.
Oh, Mountaineer, yeah.
When Neumann sent him to work, Schrodinger would have sent him over to work with him. But Neumann felt a strong obligation to take care of the young people who came especially. And he sent Mountaineer to work, just gave him the disintegration paper that he'd written in 1938. But had not published the production field.
Yeah.
Worked through it. He found that if you decompose, not as von Neumann did, very carefully, all the time, relative to the center, I will say, the center, then everything was smooth and you did things.
And you got factors. Yeah.
But that if you decompose, Mountaineer discovered that if you decompose relative to a massa, you got irreducible representations.
So that was Mountaineer's observation.
And that surprised the hell out of the night. You never believed that anything. What his intuition was telling him was that it was totally non-unique. For the reasons, the basic reasons you mentioned, that the masses can be so tremendously different. Very attractive. And temporary last comment. This, Mountaineer's paper has a horrible error. Officiated with these very The errors are everywhere.
In Mountaineer's paper?
Well, in their subject. It's that stuff.
Yeah.
But to me, you referred to Tomita's paper. I'm the one who found it.
I suspected
paper
that.
I ventured offhand that Tomita's thing was wrong. And David Edwards over in England called me and said, "Oh, it's wrong, show me." So I had to take a month off. I never learned to keep my mouth shut.
Joe Taylor had something to do with that, too,
yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah. Forcelli put him to work. We knew that there was an enormous gap. And I said, there's a counterexample to this lemma. I'm not going to take another month. It's what I did in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And Forcelli put a couple of years later, and he actually found the gap. But there was a giant gap. Neumark absorbed Tomita's paper as a chapter in his Norm Gring's book. You won't see that now because that book is another edition and that chapter disappeared. If you get hold of the old edition, you'll see it's chapter 7. Tomita's argument.
Oh, really? I have that old one. I located it.
Mackey himself made errors. Mackey was.
No!
He thought that the single generator maximal thing in algebra is in the free group limit. Were so-called simple. If you took the reflection in the commutron and generated, you get maximal affinity. In all of these ways, you don't, of course, the uniform magnifying. I had seen that years there earlier. He wrote to me about it. I don't remember that. He had a proof using disintegration theory, and he was mighty sure. We even exchanged several letters before I finally wrote out the argument that it was uniformly infinite. There's always a piece of grace. But Mackey fell into that, even Mackey fell into that trap.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
It scares the hell out of me. And the problem is you get too many sets of measure zero.
Yeah. I'm glad I didn't know that, actually. It's okay, though. It really is okay. I've even had my wife check it.
You know what, I'll be conflicted, because that's probably the event, but I'll be conflicted when there's global proof of this.
Yeah, yeah, and there should be. Yeah, that would be theorem two. That theorem two, you know, the pure state thing. Yeah. Yeah.
You can get rid of all the decomposition theory if you have
that. That's clearly the way to go. I agree. Yeah. I probably shouldn't say this because I don't want to influence people who might, younger mathematicians who might want to work on it, but I spent a lot of time trying to do this sort of global thing, and I just met one frustration after another. You know, and finally, as kind of a last resort, I tried this, and it worked. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, I had sort of reason to think it would work by then, having failed so many times to do it this other way.
Could you have your theory where you have factors instead of irreducible? Then mainly because then all these decompositions would be
factor. Yeah.
Natural, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, so you could, Bob's definition of the Schottky boundary would be a factor representation. You could do it. Yeah. And the same proof would probably work. Yeah.
Factor representation is.
Yeah.
Do stone bias process, because that's what's